Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Elizabeth Thacker Jones. This is the main course. Today, I am really honored to be interviewing Patrick Martins and Mike Edison on Patrick Martins' radio show on Heritage Radio Network. Patrick is the founder of Heritage Radio Network and is also the co-author of the Carnivores Manifesto with Mike Edison, who also is here and has a show in the network. So the tables have turned a little bit today, and I'm really honored to be here. Reading this book was, you know, I flew through it. There's actually 50 chapters in the book, and I'm dying to hear a little bit more about how it all came together. And about your collaboration and how it all started. So I'll give the mic to you, Patrick.
First of all, thanks for having me. That's very nice.
You're doing a great job already. I think you have a future at this network.
Jack, if you cancel me, if you oust me as a host,
Patrick
will be
is
very
out.
Depressed.
Elizabeth is in.
So, Elizabeth, well, I mean, just the fact that you're doing this is very nice. Did you like the book? What did you think
of
it?
I did like the book. And, you know, I didn't fully say what, you know, why you brought me on to interview you, which yeah. I think is important. I run the Food Book Fair, which is a three-day festival. We just had our third year here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We have about 80 participants that come and talk about their books. They might be writers that are, you know, getting published right then and there. Or they're going to have a book out in the future. We're all about sort of collaborating and connecting to Heritage Radio and all the great talent you have coming through here.
So these food books, can you actually eat the books?
You know, not all the books. Some of them you can eat. Some of the books you can eat.
We did have in our final chapter of the book, we predict the future. And we predict, because one of the chapters is promoting the Whole Earth Catalog, which is this famous catalog that was very important to people. It was kind of like Google before there was the internet. Mm-hmm. And we predict in this kind of like rambunctious way things the way they'll be in the year 2222. And talking about edible books, we say the 2222 edition of the Whole Earth Catalog is the first to be printed entirely on seaweed. It pairs yes. nicely with the dry soju.
Yeah, we should do that this coming year. We should experiment with it and have you back at the book fair.
That would be very nice. Well, yeah, I liked your book fair very much. I attended. It was at the White Hotel, and I'm closely associated with Dave Arnold and his Museum of Food and Drink, and you had him to talk about GMOs. I just thought it was a great venue, and it was packed. I mean, a lot of people came, so congratulations.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
So I wrote the book to answer your question. I thought that there was a lot of experiences that I had the fortune of encountering, working with all the great people I've worked with, like Carlo Petrini, Alice Waters, Michael Batterbury, Dave Arnold. And I just felt that there needed to be a book that communicated some of those funny observations these people made or that we made together, kind of going through the food world over the past 10, 15 years. But, you know, I didn't write it because, you know, while I have strong ideas about food, I wasn't a great writer. And that's where I met Mike Edison, who does a show here on the network. We met him, each other here at Roberta's. And I was like, you have my kind of writing style. I can tell just by the way you speak and the way you are. Could you write the book with me? And so I like that he came from the outside. He wasn't a food person, so he didn't use the traditional words like sustainable and is this organic? And, you know, he came at it from a different perspective, more the entertainment world. And that's why I think the book is entertaining. It has strong ideas accumulated over the years by all these people with a professional writer.
Mm-hmm. So. Some four-letter words thrown in there.
Well, you know, before this, I'd worked with Joe Bastianich on his book, and there are more F-bombs in that book than there are in the entire history of Deadwood, the TV series. No, we counted one time. It's like one per page. Oh, so there's some like 250, you know.
I started counting. I think there were like five or
well,
six.
Four of them were in the goat them. Chapter.
Yeah, which is the title of the chapter.
I am a goat.
Okay.
I had the extreme pleasure of reading the audiobook. I was the narrator of the audiobook of the Carnivore's Manifesto, and reading the the chapters from the point of view of the goat, and the chapter "I am a cow." Hello, I am a cow. The cow's being a ruminant is a little bit lazy.
Well, we did.
The goat's
did
got some kind of fucking attitude, though.
We did take out. I took out a lot of the four-letter words because I felt this was an important book and I wanted a lot of young people to read it.
And young people don't cuss.
Well, I mean, they do, but they don't need to be bombarded with it any more than it would come up naturally. I'm sure Joe doesn't say the F-bomb that much in his regular life.
Actually, I had to defuck the book.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Well, he's from Queens, you know, and that's part of the trip, and we want to try to capture a voice. I fear not the F-word. But then again, I've written for Screw and Hustler and Penthouse, and my boundaries are a little bit skewed relative to the rest of the reading.
And the Hot High Times magazine?
Yeah, I was the publisher and editor for a while of High Times magazine. So, yeah, some people have said that's not a resume, that's a crime scene.
Yeah, well, it makes the book hilarious because, honestly, it's attacking, you know, a lot of issues, a lot of serious issues that, you know, span the health of our country, of our world, and, you know, have a lot to do with how we consume. And, you know, your perspective, Patrick, as, you know, a real vanguard within the sustainable food movement, you know, really positions you to be a real voice and have and write a manifesto. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you jump right in the beginning. You talk about commodity versus quality. You know, one of the quotes I that stuck out were chicken. You know, we speak of chickens that are so sick they are juiced with an ocean of chemicals. Is meat becoming less of a commodity? You know, what's going on in our system?
Well, I mean, the meat is always a commodity. I mean, it's 98% of, I mean, I forget what the stat is. We can consume 11 billion livestock animals a year as a nation. 11 billion. Wow. So I think a lot of the questions that people ask are positioning themselves in a very small minority, like including me, you know, talking about good meat. You know, and most people are going to McDonald's once a day or Subway or Boar's Head. I mean, this is just how the world works. And so this book tries to embrace that fact because the reality is, yes, it's still a commodity. And I'm talking about less than 1% of the total meat consumed in the country. So it's but we hopefully this book provides a little bit a roadmap for people to start to slowly turn the wheel in the right direction. But, you know, we promote pepperoni on slices of New York pizza. We promote Malamars a lot. You know, mm-hmm. We promote Coca-Cola because unless you're going to make a better tasting soda, why would you make a bad imitation of Coca-Cola if Coca-Cola is better? So commodity products have their place. The main thing we're against is the suffering of animals in the commodity system. And that's what really this book is. It's why it was written, is because, you know, we're always going to eat the 11 billion livestock or close to it. So there, we shouldn't be, you know, trying to turn reality. But at the same time, those animals cannot be asked to suffer and also feed us. So, you know, the goals that it tries to do, this book is making meat a little bit less of a commodity just by putting cameras in slaughterhouses. Or expanding the cage zone for chickens. So, you know, it's providing hopefully the tools for big companies to make meat less of a commodity. It might cost more, but then maybe people should eat a little bit less meat.
Mm-hmm. And you're now at like 60,000 pounds a week of meat.
Mm-hmm.
So you've made a dent in that 1%. They're slowly making a dent.
Slowly a dent, and hopefully other groups will copy. And I mean, I've seen from when we started in 2004 to today, I mean, there's, what, dozens of butcher shops and local distribution groups and this, you know, already starting. So, you know, the more of that, the better. I mean, our goal in this book is for more farms to be producing more of our food, mm-hmm. not fewer farms.
And what about To Hell with Local, Eat the Best?
Well, that actually was called Fuck Local, Eat the Best. And I changed it at the 11th hour, and Mike was like, what the fuck did you do?
Well, first-time author, you know, I was having a little bit of writer's regret, I think.
Yeah.
Well, we'll change it to Hell with Local. I would have hated that, you know, some great person like Jessica Harris or, you know, Winona LaDuke or Hillary Clinton read the book. And they're like, this guy had to drop the F-bomb on the third chapter of the book. But basically the concept is trust your mouth, not the map. And taste is, Carlo Petrini always taught me, gastronomy is like psychology, sociology, anthropology. It's a science in and of itself. Not like physics. It's like a soft science. But it is a science, and you have to learn it, and you have to go to school for it. And that's why he opened the University of Gastronomic Sciences. And when you think that way, understanding what a meat is, what flavors might pop out, or a wine, or a cheese. That's very important. And evaluating the taste, whether it be on a scale from 1 to 10 or 5 stars, all of that becomes very important. And we should always be striving for the best and to be the best of whatever product we buy or support. And that's a really big thing, is the local food better than the best version, even if that best version comes from Italy or Spain or Nebraska. And basically that chapter is saying, you know, we should judge things by their taste and let zones that are experts at something be experts. If the best peaches come from Georgia, then let them do the Georgia pieces. They taste so much better than ones from New Jersey. Why push that on New Jersey?
I think we all agree that the less time something spends on a truck is better for all of us, but local is geography, not gastronomy.
Sure.
You know, I mean, yeah. You can't get a better bagel than right here in New York City, whether it's because of the water or the terroir of making bagels, which is something Patrick talks about as well.
Mike had a great
culture,
line.
Our culture, but, you know, here we are at sea level with this kind of water, and you just can't beat that for making a bagel. So why would someone in Oregon, where they do wonderful things and, you know, great agriculture in Oregon, but can't make a bagel?
He also said a great thing. He's like, I know pigs that refuse to hunt for Oregon truffles.
Right.
I know pigs.
That was a great line, Mike.
I know pigs.
But it's true. So, you know, I just found a lot of time going around, I taste something and I'm like, this is not good. And of course, everyone's like, this is delicious. This is the best. And some people don't know. Some people just don't want to make the farmer or the chef feel bad. But I've always kind of been of the opinion to say, hey, listen, I eat out a lot and I tasted a lot of these types of pasta. And this one's just different. I don't know how it's different, but go to these three restaurants and see. Maybe they're doing it better. Pretzels is a perfect example. You know, some people, there's 30 types of pretzels being served at restaurants. Two are among the best in the world. And the other 28, you're like, did you go and taste that one? And of course, there's opinion to taste, mm-hmm. but there's also some fact. Like you get the 100 best cheese experts in the world and say what the best cheese is, 90% of them will say Parmigiano Reggiano, best cheese in the world. Why? Because there is fact as well as opinion behind taste, mm-hmm. I think.
And also knowing how to say it, you know, knowing how to pronounce and having that sort of
vocabulary.
Yeah, the vocabulary to speak to different products. Mm-hmm. But I loved when you talked about seasonality in meat, because, you know, that plays a huge, that's geographic, but it's also climate. It's, you know, all of these layers.
Mm-hmm. He's like Ecclesiastes, right? For every season.
For every season, there's a meat. Can you quote from the Cole Porter song you wrote up?
Well, we talked, I think, from Making Whoopee, but it's about, you know, bees.
Birds do it.
Birds do it. Bees do it.
With a doodle and a cock.
With a doodle and a cock. And this is probably the first show on Heritage Radio where we've actually talked about Cole Porter's cock, but yes. We really are at the vanguard
we
here.
We should be doing more of that.
One reason I signed on to doing this book, why I wanted to work with Patrick, is because I like his ideas, and I agreed with a lot of these things. I like to think I was an early adapter of slow food, and when he said things like, it's not about local, it's about tasting the best, I loved his chapter and his ideas about don't make your own ketchup. Because we weren't adhering to this sort of Michael Pollan orthodoxy of, well, if it changes the color of your milk, you shouldn't eat it. If it's got things your grandmother can't pronounce, you shouldn't eat it, because you are going to eat some processed food in your life. It's going to happen. And we're having this meeting, sitting around eating some pizza, and Lord knows where that cheese was sourced, those tomatoes were sourced, and it's absolutely delicious. It's just a reality, that we're going to eat a club sandwich at some point in our lives, and we don't live... Patrick doesn't live in some hippie utopia, even though his business is very responsible, and I admire him very much for trying to promote a cruelty-free, sustainable food system. And the truth is, I personally try not to eat factory farm food because it tastes bad.
But even you will have a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich in the morning from a greasy
it's
diner.
It's a classic New York sandwich, a bacon, egg, and cheese. And
I'm eating one right now.
And that is the that's the result of a very cruel system. I mean, it's garbage food. It really is.
But regarding your question to the seasonality, it's funny. I go do a lot of staff trainings because we're very lucky to be supported by 80 restaurants in New York and probably another 80 around the country. And mainly in New York, I go around. I do staff trainings right during the shift change around 4 or 5 o'clock. And I hit 3 or 4 points, survival of the fattest, which you might ask me about in a bit, and this issue that we just brought up, and it's very interesting. Most of the people in the restaurant industry, they kind of know it barely, like from the depths of their kindergarten days, but they haven't thought about it for years, and that is turkeys that mate naturally. They have sex in the winter, late winter. They're born in the spring, and they're ready for eating in the fall, November, really. Mm-hmm. That's why we have the tradition. Same with lamb, same with goats, same with ducks, same with geese. And it's just funny. People are like, oh, my God, that turkey sandwich that I just had this morning or this afternoon, that was an artificially inseminated turkey, because that's not how it works. And it's just funny. It's like the cycles of the moon, the earth orbiting the sun, that all gives us the earth's bounty according to a timeline. And only chickens and cows and pigs have sex all the time. All the other ones, while they might make out and get to first, second, maybe third base, they're not going all the way and making kids. So it's just funny. So what we say in that chapter is every season has its meat. Don't eat hamburger meat from cows when it's Easter and there's lamb on every farm exploding all over the place, or turkeys are being prepared everywhere. And instead of also another thing that chapter says is you don't do one spectacular meal necessarily and say we supported goat this October. Maybe you make goat a meat for 6 or 7 meals in a row and really embrace livestock by season.
Goat-tober. I would love that.
Turkvember and Ducksember.
And that goes, with everything. I mean, I can't imagine eating, with agriculture, eating like, a cantaloupe out of season. It invariably tastes bad. It's been on, a truck. It's been on a boat. And the problem is, we talk about this a lot in the book, too, is it's the speed at which we live and becoming disconnected from the earth. Mm-hmm. And I think that, it devalues us as humans when we become disconnected from the world in which we live.
I love knowing that in December I'm going to have 6 geese in my freezer, and I'll pull them out and I'll cut one in half and cook that, and then the next day I'll make a Niçoise salad but with goose meat instead of the tuna, and then the next week I'll grind it up through the grinder and make tartare. That's fun.
I do love a goose. I made goat chili this year during Goat-tober, and I got absolute raves. It was probably the best chili I ever made with goat meat.
Well, you're eating a fresher animal too, that's its time.
Oh yeah, those goats are fresh. Sassy.
It's nature speaking to us. They are sassy.
Having written a chapter from the point of view of a goat. Very in tune with my goat brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Well, jumping around a bit, tétoir, which you mentioned earlier, that comes up pretty early. And that's a term that you coined.
Thank you very much. It's not that I always do that with my brain. I always try to think of a synonym. I'm like, what word goes with that? So tétoir, I thought of that many years ago. I did come up with a new word, by the way, which I invented, which you are one by having done the book fair. Mike, not so much. But no, just kidding. It's an actioneer.
Actioneer.
An actioneer. You know, it's a positive, active word. You know, they have words. People have done something with ear. I forget, like, it's pioneers.
Like, or pioneer.
Pioneer. They've co-opted the ioneer part. But, actioneers are people that are doing things, I think, with the bent towards good. Mm-hmm. But, you know, anyone who really just pulls them up by their bootstraps and organizes as an entrepreneur, brings people together in a way that hasn't been done before. And then the only other word I ever invented was is Tetwar. Well, I did invent one more. I invented the origin of ridicchio, but it's not factual, but tetwar is basically the terroir of the mind, and terroir is the influence that the soil has on an agricultural product. Tetwar is the influence that the mind has on the hands and the brain, and it's passed on from creative people, one creative person to another. It's also the possibility of a locus to just develop its own tetwar and breed expertise in a field.
Mm-hmm. And you identify that, so it's also a movement or a trend, perhaps. So you identify 12 of them in the book.
Well, I mean, I did the very meta ones with Mike. We really thought about it. And so, you know, a lot of them are cities, you know, Kansas City, Portland. And we left it to others, if the word ever catches on, to find tetwar in their more local spheres.
But also movements. It's a culture. Tetwar is a culture. We talk about beer brewing, craft brewing, which is a huge movement, and in America is really, I mean, it's changed the landscape of beer drinking.
And tetwar built when one brewmaster came back from Europe, opened a brewery, and taught an apprentice. That was tetwar building. And then that apprentice hires two assistants, and then one assistant moves to San Francisco and starts a brewery, and tetwar starts to build there. And in a place like Portland, there's so much tetwar for beer that it's already past all the individuals doing it. It's just a city that great beer people flock to.
And not just with food. Also, when we talk about, you know, Chicago being the tetwar of the electric blues, and Mississippi being, you know, really the foundation of rural blues, and New York maybe being a tetwar more of jazz and Tin Pan Alley.
You talked about fashion.
I'm using a music metaphor. But I mean, here in New York, our tetwar is we've got probably more talent per square foot than any other place in the world.
Mm-hmm. Whether and that's fashion or making a bagel or designing concept and logos.
You know, and the tetwar of writers here in Brooklyn and the rest of New York as well. I mean, that's our tradition here is a creative one, and we do share it. We hand it down, and it builds on itself.
And tête is head, of course, French for head. So terre is ground, tête is head.
And the best
War
thing
is, like,
is that
this
word has met such widespread approval that I believe you're going to be named a chevalier of the who's a what's this in France. They love it there. They love you in France.
It's
like,
actually
like Jerry Lewis. They love you there.
Jack, who was the Jack is the producer. There was a French newspaper that actually covered the tetwar word. Was it called La Libération?
That's right.
Okay, La Libération. Which is cool that a French paper broke the tetwar word.
Yeah, this is when this came out.
Yeah, no, this was actually, she just was covering the station.
Oh.
They interviewed me, and she's like, do you have a word for what exists here? I was like, do I? Tetwar.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I was lucky.
Wow. So it's already taking off.
In France.
And you, actually brought slow food from Italy to the U.S.
Well, it had existed here already in places like Portland and Sonoma and New York, of course. And then many people knew about it. But what I did is I, you know, developed a newsletter so that we could print news about what was happening on the chapter level here. I helped start chapters. And I basically brought Carlo's idea of the arc of taste, the metaphorical arc of taste, where endangered foods were boarded onto this metaphorical arc in an effort to promote them so that more people would eat them, farmers would make more money raising these endangered products, whether it be an eggplant or a kind of potato or a type of turkey. And that was the vehicle. The arc was our vehicle towards communicating slow food ideas. And every chapter was frantically looking around in their local communities for what their products were. And that's really what started slow food.
And you have a whole chapter about Carlo Petrini.
Mm-hmm. And he was a real movement maker. And I respect CEOs. My father-in-law is a corporate CEO. So that takes a type of leadership also. But I really appreciate the leadership where people are taking huge risks, like forming a book fair with no particular precedent in your life, or, you know, convincing some fancy hotel to give you their lobby. You know, that takes a certain type of actioneer energy. It's a genetical thing, you know. Genetical?
Why not?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. After saying actioneer and tetwar, you're like, you can get away with genetical.
And so, you know, the mixologist as the chef or the cook, that was something brand new to me. Nose to tail. Let's grind.
Well, you know, I think the culture is changing. I just, you know, the thing about the slow food and all of this, I'd lived in Spain for some years and spent a lot of time in Europe, and the whole time never ate in one trendy restaurant. We always ate local food when I was traveling. I used to be in a rock and roll band that played all the time all over Europe, and we always ate the local food, not because it was hip or trendy, but because we knew it was better. And some kid who was promoting the show, his dad invariably, you know, ran the local maison and took us over there, and the meat came from a local farm, and the agriculture was local, and the wine was from that region. I understood this, that the personality that came through the land and also the culture, which we now call the terroir. So it was very simple to make this move. And when I cook at home, it was the same thing. Simple always seemed to be much better. And also, in the end, less expensive, really. Just to keep simple ingredients. That's the Italian table. That's what Joe and Lydia always talk about. And it's one reason I got along so well with Joe when we did the book, because I got it. There's really nothing much better than a meatball, which we talk about. A simple meatball and some pasta and a good glass of table wine, and it's like the perfect meal.
Takes 20 minutes. It costs $3 to eat per person if you make pasta with a little bit of meat ragu. It's the cheapest food
there is. And when it comes to making a steak, the only other ingredient I really need is fire.
Yeah.
I mean, if the meat is good, I don't need to, like, hide it in a bunch of sauces.
These four-hour, six-hour braises, I think, have a little bit to do with meat, that movement. A little bit to do with meat not tasting as good anymore.
Interesting.
And so you had to do this stuff. And also these culinary Mardi Gras parade flight of flavors, that's a really cool thing to do sometimes. But I think people had to do it. If you had people coming over and you were going to be judged on how unique what you cooked was and what influences and what cookbook you used, you were going to put red wine and cook it for 3 weeks and then brine and this and that, when in reality slow food should be seen as fast food. 10 minutes or less, you and your kids are eating a simple steak or hamburger. I mean, you just throw flat meat on a grill, it gets hot. You can put it on a pasta or just eat it alone with some bread and ketchup.
The important thing is that the slow part happened before you took the food home. That's the slow part. And I really do believe that if you start out with good ingredients, it's really hard to fuck up a good meal.
Yeah. There is something to be said about that long cook, though, because it just gives you the chance to drink more beer.
Yes, yes. I always go for Gibson's, unless I know the bartender, like Damon Bolte, who does a great show on the network called The Speakeasy. Him, I'm like, what do you want? Sometimes he asks me to name my liquor, but oftentimes he'll just ask how I'm feeling. But the one Gibson, and you're there. That's why I drink more Gibson's and cook slow food fast.
When I make the goat chili, when I make any chili, I usually start with a 40-ouncer of beer. And usually half goes in the chili and the other half goes in the boy.
He also drinks Budweiser in the shower.
I'm actually moving away from Budweiser, I got to say, because I do believe
Bud Light finally?
I understand that Heineken's using still all natural ingredients, that there's no GMO grains and hops and corn in Heineken, and the Budweiser is
doesn't the same recipe. Country
I was
both?
I was loyal to Bud for a long time, but since they've been bought by InterBev and become so corporate, I understand they're using cheaper ingredients, and I do believe the taste profile has changed, which is hard for me to deal with because it's been so consistent for so long.
Yeah, I like Sam Adams. I feel like they've done
Jim Kotz, you know, a great
probably the most successful of all those. Small breweries that became middle-sized breweries.
Yeah, it's big. I mean, it was Sam Adams that really put the fear of God into the major beer producers. And I remember seeing Jim Cott at a beverage conference. I used to work for Beverage World magazine, my days as a trade journalist. And at 7 in the morning, he'd be up there speaking, and the first thing he would do was open up one of his beers. And I love that because the guy believed in his product.
Well,
he also legitimized morning beer, which is also very important.
The middle-sized brewing companies. We have some great beer references. I mean, Sierra Nevada, we mentioned once. That's a middle-sized company. Brooklyn Brewery is one.
Yeah.
Sam Adams is one. New Belgium, I think, is a big Colorado one. Anchor Steam, they've become national, but I have great respect for those guys.
More meat guys
need success stories like those breweries. They go from small to medium. That's where the line is right now. We need to be getting more small guys to get more medium, including by working together. But the brewing revolution is awesome.
Well, you know, speaking of Anchor Steam Beer and the Anchor Brewery, Fritz Maytag, who is the brewmaster, their third generation brewmaster, gave this presentation once I saw when I was in the beer business. He talked about a lot of things. He talked about how Prohibition put his family out of business and all these things that Prohibition affected that we don't usually think about. You know,
they got into cheese, I think, maybe because of that Maytag Blue, right? Is them.
And the washers and dryers.
No, but that is them.
They were forced to go into other businesses, agriculture and also soda pop. But what he said is that he loved making beer, and he said it's part of the speech. And later I had him sign a photo of himself to me with this written on it. He says, I love making beer. I have the best job in the world. Every day I wake up and try to put something better in the bottle. And I just thought that was the best, that this guy had that attitude. I mean, making beer is a privilege, right? And he knew it. And he knew when he stopped feeling that way about it, it was time to get out of the business. And I wish more people would feel that way, because
we have such a great beer show. Beer Sessions is a real chronology and database of all of these great brewers around the country. He's done more than 200 shows on the network. But that's really
Jimmy Carbone.
Beer Sessions. It's a great mapping area for people who want to learn more about beer.
And so back to meat. Vegetarians, you have blood on your hands. Is this like preaching?
Catch it, don't you think?
I mean,
One line I felt bad about in that chapter where we said that vegetarian restaurants kind of, we implied necessarily that they serve goopy.
Oh, they suck.
Goopy, droopy, terrible.
Oh, the
tasting
vegetarian restaurants.
Well, then that's just a trend. Alice Waters once said, "Oh, I'm not a hippie restaurant. Chippenese is not hippie because hippie restaurants have bad connotations against local.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily.
We've been to great vegetarian restaurants, of course, and had amazing vegetarian meals. And we both like to eat a lot of vegetables, but unfortunately, and maybe we are a stereotype. It's a bit of a cliche, but it's a real experience I've had over the years, the East Village, repeatedly going into restaurants and getting like goopy tahini sauce and bad noodles and the wind chimes and Joni Mitchell and all these trappings of that part of the culture that are being inflicted upon me, so they could put the word vegetarian, over the awning out in front. And the truth is, any good responsible restaurant should be able to serve
That's
a good
point.
Vegetarian meal. And the fact that
Gramercy Tavern vegetarian is a better vegetarian restaurant than almost any other vegetarian. They don't call them. They don't need to call themselves that. They just have vegan and vegetarian options.
And the rare chance, rare opportunity we get to serve a vegan when we're on my radio show, we give them the Pizza Rosa, which is a beautiful pizza. And there's not even any cheese on it, of course, just the sauce and garlic. It's one of my favorites here. But it's a legit.
Don't go that far.
No, it is. I love it. It's so light. It's great. I usually use that to start to open up for like the heavier, bigger meat-filled pizzas.
To be clear, we say, the vegetarians have their heart completely in the right direction. But but if they had possibly dedicated these past 30, 40 years when they've been a real big part of, had a big voice on the national food scene, if they had been fighting for cameras in slaughterhouses, bigger cages for chickens, they would have been in a real world, bettering a big part of the world project. Versus trying to get people to stop eating meat. We eat too much meat in this country.
That's how I interpret it, is that there are a lot of vegetarians who made the choice to stop eating meat because they didn't know where their meat was coming from.
Right.
And now there's
more options.
A lot of options.
Food trucks, to Heritage Foods mail order, to your local butcher.
I also respect the moral imperative that some vegetarians feel. That's fine. Who am I to judge? What I don't like is militantism.
Yeah.
Because I am a carnivore, I'm an omnivore, and, what do you say to the lion who's, chewing up a zebra on the Serengeti that, we should all be more involved, not eat meat? I mean, God gave us these teeth, to eat meat. I mean, squashing tomatoes is real nice, but that's not what I got these incisors for.
If you really look at it, this book, it rails against fast food and says we should always avoid fast food whenever possible, including people who are poor. They should not be told to eat fast food. So if you consider how much we rail against the industrial complex, this book might be the greatest manifesto for vegetarianism ever written. If you consider how small a percentage of the supply we're actually promoting, this is actually a great vegetarian book. It backs up why maybe people should consider that unless they know the source.
Mm-hmm. I think that counts as genuine irony.
Yeah, well, also the hunting aspect, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that...
Well, that's who we are.
I'm afraid someone's going to shoot me for calling the NRA amoral.
They are. Fuck them.
What do you mean? They are going to shoot me?
No, but fuck them. I mean, they are amoral. They're irresponsible. They're crass.
That's Mike Edison talking.
That's right. Come find me.
232 38th Street.
But yeah, I mean, you know, there are people who conflate, you know, gun control with gun violence, and that's just a terrible message that they're sending out. But we are hunters. Mm-hmm. As a culture, as a race of humans, that's what we do. We are hunters.
The point of that chapter was the NRA, because we are pro-hunting, Carnivore's Manifesto. We make these declarations. The Carnivore Manifesto declares, and you know, that we are pro-hunter. And that's why we said, as Mike wrote, it really puts a bee in our bonnet when they conflate our desire to move assault weapons off of our streets with a slippery slope that's going to lead to President Obama pulling guns out of their house. That's not fair, because we are pro-guns, and most Americans are, but it's just those very top-edge, multi-clip ammo tank, that whole world, that's what we're arguing. But don't confuse
the two. Also, this idea that meat comes in shrink wrap. And that's it.
And never actually
to see the process. And people who might be against killing an animal, but will happily eat the end product. And there's a bit of hypocrisy there. I mean, we all should know where our food comes. And this book is obviously very pro-education more than anything.
That's a Julia Child quote. I think anyone who is a carnivore needs to understand that meat does not originally come in these neat little packages.
Yeah. There are so many great quotes in the book, by the way. Every chapter, all 50 chapters start with a quote. From, you know, Thoreau to Alice Waters.
Come out and see us on the road, Churchill.
And you can play a game of who said that.
Deborah Madison.
Yep, if you are what you eat, then you're fast, cheap, and easy.
Yeah, that's so good.
She just saw that on a bumper sticker, and she told me it, so she gets credit for it. And by the way, when she told me and I told a few people, everyone started saying it. Like in 2005 or 6, everyone was like, yeah, we've heard that one before. Boo. And now it's back. It's been enough time.
It's great. Well, I just want to say personally, chapter 22, sleep with your butcher, maybe your bartender. Hilarious.
Is something you live up to?
Well, this second page, it's not something I lived up to, but, you know, I'm working on it. You mention my last name, Jones, and my hometown, Scarsdale, in the same sentence.
Wow. Sort of like the Da Vinci Code. It's like our little Da Vinci Code of meat.
Yeah.
That is very interesting. Well, that was you saying maybe your butcher doesn't know this from that.
Well, you know, the whole, it's, you know, it again speaks to the idea that, food is a very intimate thing. You put it in your mouth, and you should be very up close and personal with the people who source your food, and you should know them. And that to be part of a truly sustainable food movement, you should shop at different vendors. You should have a butcher and a baker, and not just buy all your stuff at one big conglomerate. You should know your local farmers. And the truth is, the whole thing about this book and why I got behind it and why I loved it is because if you really do take the advice, even in the smallest possible way, your life is better. Food will be better. You'll be much better off eating organic and, you know, cruelty-free meat. I mean, I can't even imagine eating something that says Purdue or Tyson on it. And not that I did before the book started, but even more hardcore now. Like no way. And the food is better. It tastes better. I feel better. I'm proud to say I've never actually been in a McDonald's in New York City. And I certainly have been on, like, the Indiana Highway or, you know, the Ohio, you know, in Ohio, mm-hmm. because that's the only choice. But here, where I have options, mm-hmm. there's no fucking way I'm going to McDonald's. I mean, politically, it's repulsive, and the food makes me sick on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you should know your butcher, and the idea of sleeping with your butcher is like sleeping with your bartender. You said, which you do, I know, right?
Cheesemonger.
Well, cheesemonger. You know,
Patrick yeah. married his cheesemonger.
I sleep with my cheesemonger.
But, you know, the idea is to know these people and they know you, and you always, you know, the relationship is very, very important. And in the end, it really, really pays off, the quality you get. And he knows you, right, Damon? You walk in, he said, oh, my God, look at Patrick. You need your Gibson.
I would never order a Gibson with Damon, but that's too simple a drink. But I do think that people forget in this day and age with Yelp and the New York Times and all this. They forget the beauty of being a regular somewhere. Mm-hmm. And they don't go out of their way to go to the same place. And therefore, most of those people suffer in some way in whatever. So let's say for restaurants, oh, I was waiting at the bar. They told me a half hour. It was really an hour and a half. Oh, we needed to add one more person. They had room, but they said no. Those little things, that's why you want to become a regular. It's that place that you can call up and say, we're a six top. It's 9 p.m. Can we be there in a half hour? And they're like, you might have to wait 20 minutes, but we will make it work. Or a bartender who's like, don't order that drink, order this one. Or don't take those lamb chops because, you know, they're good, but I want you to try this better. And then he gives you a free gift on top of that. And you're like, that's the beauty of being a regular. And I think people are too often seeing what's new and what's fresh. And that should be a part of the thing, too. But go back to the places that you love.
Well, yeah. You can't just shop on convenience and price point always and expect to get the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you say, I think, don't be scared of that. You know, it doesn't. There's no expectation the morning after.
Exactly. And exactly, right. And if you know the maitre d', give the guy $20, or someone butchers you or your loin and your thing and makes your little rose, give him $5. That will pay off times 1,000 in the future if you're a regular. Just those things. And if you're like, do I give the guy $10? Absolutely give him $10. And just if he says no, then don't, you know, take it back. But chances are that will literally pay off on the very next visit.
Friends with benefits.
Yeah.
That's what you want, you know.
And, you know, you spend $200 on a meal, and then you're like, should I slip the guy a 20? Absolutely. That has no effect on the total price, you know. And yet it's significant because it's bringing bigger awareness to their importance.
But it's an investment. I mean, we wrote this book, and we assume people are reading it because we like to eat. At the end of the day, it's pleasurable, aside from whatever sustenance it may provide. Mm-hmm. We want it to be a great experience, and that's why you do that. That's why you have a relationship with the guy at your mm-hmm. restaurant and the guy behind the butcher counter and your baker and your...
Erin Fairbanks was always said this about me. She's the executive director. Here she is. She's like, God, you always give this guy cigarettes, the porter of the building. You always give him to me. He stops by. You give him 3 cigarettes. You don't even say hello. Why is that? And then over the weeks that we would work together, she'd be like, how come that guy brings you your mail all the time? And then no one else can ever get the mail. She's like, oh, right.
Because you bought him off for 3 cigarettes. This
for
is like
three
prison.
Cigarettes
it's like
a
prison.
Week. Yeah. Well, basically. But those 3 cigarettes ended up meaning worlds more than just being like, hey, dude, where's my fucking mail?
You know? Well, it's like the shared economy, but in real life, you know, it's not like the world of Kickstarter where you're sort of, you mm-hmm. know, that, I mean, that's a great platform too, but, you know, you have these real
invest life locally
interactions. Well,
if you're going to pass your doorman or the guy at the deli or even your local homeless guy 6 times a day. That guy's part of the fabric of your life, and, you know, how can you be good to him? And heightened awareness of these quotidian social fabric things is a lot what this book is about, too.
Look, I'm with Alice when she says, you know, no, it's not a hippie restaurant. But, you know, we have chosen to be thoughtful, and we've chosen kindness over cruelty, and we've chosen compassion over the alternative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if that makes us a, you know, hippie, meet hippies. You know, I can handle that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
Nouveau
good.
Nouveau hippie.
Yes.
I think.
Well, you know,
well,
I mean,
hipster
listen,
is
listen,
what that's
we
called.
Talk about
hipster.
That too, but
there's
listen,
a chapter on that.
Every social movement since the beginning of time has been maligned, and no one more than the hippies. I mean, but listen, there are the filthy hippies who turned Haight-Ashbury into like an open air homeless shelter, and then there's the hippie who started Apple computers. You know, they're the Clintons and the Beatles. And
the Clintons protested the war in Vietnam, you know, and ended up in the White House.
And then there's you, Patrick.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But if just being kind, you know, makes us a hippie, if we like peace over war, I can handle that.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the beginning you say, do not buy food from publicly traded companies.
And then we say right after that, that's a tough rule to follow because everyone will eat 30-40% of their stuff processed food or fast food, like the bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich. But that's a great model.
If we can do that 80% of the time.
I mean, the main idea is that
they're not in the business of taste or money. They're just in the business of money.
That's right. They're not responsible to the people to whom they should be responsible.
Short-term investor dividends. That is all they have 100% and will lie and cheat and abuse animals in the effort to achieve that.
Swap out ingredients and practice unfair, you know, labor practices.
Pump saline solution into turkey carcasses to goose the weight and to make it taste better. There is nothing these guys won't do. And, you know, we really have to look at these livestock. And pigs are just as intelligent as dogs. These guys are Nazi-like bio-wrenching. It is not fair. And those guys and women and all those CEOs, they should be ashamed of themselves because they don't allow cameras in there because they know. And I'm not talking about cameras on CNBC. I'm talking about let Temple Grandin check it out. I mean, a third-party arbiter, someone they buy into as well. But, you know, those animals suffer. Survival of the fattest. They suffer before confinement. They suffer because they're bad genetics, mm-hmm. bred to grow too fast. And I don't think anyone's been monitoring those guys or holding them accountable to any standard when it comes to humaneness on that level.
Yeah. So. Well, you are the authority, and this is quite a tome you have. Really, it's impressive.
Thank you for reading it.
Are you going to take it on the road? Or?
We are going to Aaron Fairbanks is coming. The two people I work with at Heritage Foods are coming, Catherine and Alexis.
Great.
Mike and I. We're doing an event at Roberta's on June 10th. Then June 12th, we're at Hotel Vitale in San Francisco. June 13th, we are doing Fatted Calf and Buy Rights, 18 Reasons. It's a great market out there.
18 Reasons.
Saturday, we're doing Book Passage, and our friend Angelo Garo is opening his forge to us for a Rabelaisian feast.
That's in the Ferry Building, right?
Exactly. For the Book Passage, yep. And mm-hmm. then Sunday, we go to Farmstead. For a big picnic concert series where we'll be signing books and hopefully be on stage. And then Eugene in Portland finalize the trip. So.
And you're going to Shed in Healdsburg too, right?
Yes. Is that a famous place?
Stephanie Kalamanis is one of my best friends from growing up.
Does she know you were interviewing me?
I just was texting her earlier today.
She just emailed me and asked for, you know, we were talking about the food that's going to get served. It's Father's Day that we're signing there. So.
You're doing ribs.
Yeah. Ribs, exactly.
That's great.
It's sort of like, we're sort of like meaty pranksters.
What? We're calling it a kind of a MASH variety show.
Yeah, because the Magical Meat Tour.
He's an expert theremin player. I don't know if you knew that about him.
Half theremin will travel. I don't know how expert I am, but I can make a pretty good racket.
Wow, that's awesome.
But yeah, we'll bring in the acoustic guitars and
have special guest guitarists join you.
You'll be putting bells on your toes and feathers in your hair, right, Patrick?
Whatever it takes to sell books.
Goddamn straight.
So Little Brown is your publisher.
Little, comma, Brown.
Right, part of the Hachette Group, currently being squashed by, you know, the corporate giant Amazon.
Yeah, you know,
our book is not available.
Hachette is there. Yeah,
this is a dueling. Bad turn of events. I mean, I was hoping they would resolve it more quickly because I've felt this before. I had a book that came out with Macmillan before, and the same thing. And
it's ridiculous.
You know, I don't know.
We just go to barnesandnobles.com. Mm-hmm. Is a very easy one, or support your local bookstore.
Support your local bookstore
and come out and see us on the road and get one right from the source.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be giving out meaty prizes, and Aaron will be predicting the future of food and what things will be like a few hundred years from now. So for your great, 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 great grandchildren, please come to these events.
And get it signed by both of you. Which
yes.
I'm going to do right now.
Oh, very nice.
It never gets tired, right?
Oh, I have my Sharpie right in my pocket.
Always a privilege.
Yes, thank you so much. You're a great host.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, thank you for having me.
I just got texted by Aaron while we were on that I'm out. You're out. You're the new host of the main course.
Well, I could never fill your shoes, but I appreciate your having me.
How do
today.
We follow the book fair for people who want to learn more about food books?
We're really active on social media. So at Food Book Fair on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We hope to do a couple other events in the interim, and we might actually do something out west in the Bay Area next year as well. So we're growing a little bit, which is exciting. And please follow us. And we'll have both of you back next year at the book fair because you'll still be, you know, on the circuit.
I personally think this book is going to be...
tell your stories from the road.
Yeah, it'll be respected posthumously. This book, it'll take a while for it to simmer. No, but I mean, I do think 6 months from now, it'll still be active, hopefully.
Yeah, I think it will.
I think so. I think the book is always going to be relevant. I mean, the ideas in the book are as timeless as the concept of farming itself.
As timeless as your space theremin, Mike.
I think anyone who's interested in food books should read this book.
Wow. Yeah. If only you had opened with that. Well, thanks. For having me.
Thanks so much.
All right. Okay. You want to sign off like a professional radio
off.
Host?
Signing off. 10-4. Is Jack completely asleep back there?
No, I'm waiting to see how you guys sign off here.
Over and out.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.